seems so far away.
Experiencing the anxieties of the body and not being open, sort of unlived extreme situations, I can, even though I could be in the worst sort of state, but just sort of here. And I recall that if I was in a calmer or a better state, I'd be able to live a lot easier.
So, what you're saying is that when you're distraught, it's hard for you to listen.
Yeah.
So, what makes you distraught? What would you say makes you distraught?
Say relationships,
family, romance,
yeah,
makes you distraught.
Yeah. Anxieties around career.
Will you get the job you want, or will you be prepared enough for the job you want, or will the job you're preparing for now still exist in a few years? Are you preparing for a job in which there's going to be a great scarcity of employees in the future, or will it? It's like I remember when I was a teenager, all my relatives were telling me, you've got to be an engineer. There's such a shortage of engineers these days, in all fields of engineering. You've got to be an engineer. Your uncle, he's a civil engineer. He's really native. He's really, he's really doing fine. I remember my mother used to bring home from the library all these books for you about careers. You can be an engineer, or your future life as a chemical engineer. Okay, so 10 years later, what happened? By the time I was in my mid-20s, you'd always read newspapers in the States all the time. There's a glut of engineers. There are too many engineers. And all my friends who had been studying preparatory courses to become engineers since they were teenagers, and now they're in their mid-20s, they weren't getting jobs because there were too many engineers. So yes, it's an anxiety idea. Now, what do you think the solution is to these anxieties you mentioned? Relationships, family, romance, career?
Working on my own, working on the internal side of me, my aspects that make that important, that make that effective. Think about the relationship to all the career and family.
Of course, you could also say that since I am, this is a controversial point, since I am disturbed about relationships and career, that means that all my effort, should be directed to making society holding society responsible. Yes, because of society, my relationships are faulty, and because of society, I don't have career security. Think about that.
Blame, the responsibility, I didn't even look at it that way before. Oh, I used to.
But then, I'm just making stirring things up a bit. But then some will say, back in my freshman year at university, I would say, you have been victimized by the oppressive rulers, colonists, who take your vision away from the actual exploitation going on, so you'll simply, you know, think, no, we shouldn't blame society, we shouldn't blame the powers that be, whatever. We should simply cope with ourselves. But my freshman year at the university, I was, yes, he has been brainwashed by the colonizers.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm giving you new possibilities. Okay, so then I guess what happened after my freshman year at university, I thought that, well, I began to study histories of different places that had the revolution and the downtrodden became the overlords. Former overlord became a downtrodden, and I saw that it didn't make any difference. The outs became the ins, and the ins became the outs, and the same old problems remained. Why? Because there is no higher understanding. As long as we are thinking, I am the body, and that the highest purpose of society is to provide security and pleasure for my body, then there'll always be exploitation. Because in order to satisfy the body, that automatically entails utilizing other bodies. That mean? Whether it's in the innocuous form as a family, you keep them around you for a while anyway. They're kind of like your shield, you know? What's that?
Buttons.
Buttons?
Yeah.
There are buttons on your Yes, and they make you feel wanted for a while anyway. You decide this family is binding me and getting in my way and you push it apart. But generally, people surround themselves with families and friends or lovers, varying degrees, to utilize, to use in a nice way, to fill up the space in the room, to make it so you don't have to think too much about yourself because you're always interacting with others, making merry, trading mirth, trading the tears and the joy.
What's the mirth?
Lighthearted, making merry, letting the big mouth go. So when you have your families and friends, your mates around you, when you trade the laughter, you trade the tears, the size, the expectations, the disappointments. So it's just these things are being traded back and forth all the time, exchanged. And this way, the days and nights pass, and there's no solution, but all the trading is going on. It's like it's a stock exchange, you know? A lot of trading activity, but no profit at the end, you know, at the end. But anyway, by all that trading and swapping, you don't have to be left naked to realize, I don't know who I am, I don't know why I'm in this world, I don't know where I come from or where I'm going. So as I was talking earlier with Joan, and Joan here, that therefore what appears to be good, altruistic, or beneficial for to make people feel happy in the ordinary sense, can actually be a detriment, can actually be causing problems because it obscures the real issues. You see my point now? The whole of materialistic society has been functioning in a way to obscure the real issues. Now, in a proper civilization, as Krishna is talking about here, one in which the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita is handed down from administration to administration, in that proper human society, the purpose of having stability is so that people can focus on the issues unobscured, unharassed by so many distractions. Now, modern society works in the opposite way. They're wanting stability so that things can be obscured. Stability so that so many activities can go on without being impeded. And what is the purpose of these activities? To obscure. Whereas real human society wants stability so that people can analyze these basic issues without things being obscure. So there's a complete difference in purpose. The two purposes are diametrically opposite. So much of what, in fact, most of what we call material advancement in our society, it refers to that which covers or obscures the real issues. Whereas what Krishna is talking about here in text 2 is a society in which everything is geared towards making it so the issues are right out in the open. So the expert philosopher, chief executive, the expert philosopher king, manages the social system so that things are always out in the open. They're always out in the open, unobscured. Understand? For example, okay, I don't know much about how this is being resolved, but I just saw on the newsstand today that there's some, about the Cave Creek disaster, there's some scandal about that. Does anyone know what it is?
Something like that.
Headlines on the listener magazines, Cave Creek scandal. What's that?
These bolts not mailed.
And someone brought it to some inspector, mentioned it 3 months ago, and no one did anything about it, and something like that. So, yes, on one level, say, no doubt. The government should make sure that the observation platforms are always inspected. So, people are thinking, let us bring it out into the open. Let us stick to the bottom of this. Should we use bolts instead of nails on the observation platform? How often should the inspections be? This is really getting to the root of the problem. This is what government is for. This is what, concerned citizens should be thinking about. To avoid such disasters, to prevent negligence. Now, in a society which is formed around spiritual principles, that would be the most insignificant issue. So in such a society, the government leaders would make it their business, of course, to, yes, the roads should be constructed safely, paths, the bridges, the observation platforms should be safe, but there will be always danger in this world. If you fix all the observation platforms in New Zealand to exceed even the most rigid expectations of stress. Nevertheless, people will die another way. Just the fact they have bodies means that there'll be a disaster. What does that mean? the fact that you're providing me what you're there for.
Help me is that sooner or later it's not going to be here.
Right! Everybody's going to come to that disaster sooner or later.
You just know it doesn't really matter how it happens, it's still a disaster.
Oh, that'd be good.
Is that
what we're saying? It means there's no such thing as accidents.
Can you enlarge upon that?
Well, if people are going to die, they're going to die no matter what happens.
Yes.
And it's like, their time's up. Their out of body has said, right, you're out of here, time for another one, move on.
Yes. So therefore, that doesn't mean, okay, we shouldn't care about the safety of the observation platform so everyone's going to die. That's one extreme. And the other extreme is, we've got to really study these observation platforms and how they're constructed, and, you know, we're going to make sure it never happens again. Yes, you. Okay, maybe you make it so that no more observation platforms collapse in the New Deal. But something else will happen.
Yeah, it's intuition then, isn't it? For that person to be there at that particular time.
Intuition, okay.
Intuition,
That what person?
If the person's going to go to somebody that a disaster's going to happen, surely something must kind of tell them not to go there, and not to be in that place.
Well, you're just reading. I think before you came in, we'll turn back to Jones verse, the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Page 845.
What page? 845.
The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart.
O Arjuna.
And is directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of material energy.
Can you read the first one, please?
What was it? Arjuna was not the supreme knower, and his decision to fight or not to fight was confined to his limited discretion. Lord Krishna instructed that the individual is not all in all. The supreme personality of Godhead, or he himself, Krishna, as a localized super soul, sits in the heart, directing the living being. After changing bodies, the living entity forgets his past deeds. But the super soul, as the knower of the past, present and future, remains the witness of all his activities. Therefore, all the activities of living entities are directed by the super soul. The living entity gets what he deserves, and is carried by the material body, which is created in the material energy under the direction of the super soul. As soon as a living entity is placed in a particular type of body, he has to work under the spell of that bodily situation. A person seated in a high-speed motor car goes faster than one seated in a slow car. So the living entities, the drivers may be the same. Similarly, by order of the Supreme Soul, material, nature, fashion, a particular type of body to a particular type of living entity, so that he may work according to his past desires. The living entity is not independent. One should not think himself independent of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The individual is always under the Lord's control. Therefore, one's duty is to surrender. And that is the injunction of the Lord's
Thank you. Any questions about that?
That is very nice. Is it your first time here?
Yes.
I would say, a particular type of body to a particular type of living entity, so that you may work at doing it at the time.
Let's think that there is and often a perfect hotel in that you go to the reception desk and no matter what kind of desire you have, the hotel has a room that caters to that desire. So nature, under the direction of Krishna, is the perfect hotel. It has already been figured out in advance all the different types of desires of the enemies can have. And therefore, the system of bodies has already been figured out in advance. Under the direction of Krishna, the super soul in everyone's heart, you are directed to take a particular type of body according to your cherished desire. Desire is your thing. Your desire.
What do you mean by that? When you say
you
are free, yeah.
So I have the soul
you.
Has free will before coming to material world.
Excuse me?
The soul has free will before coming to material world.
Always. Desire is the most subtle principle of existence. It actually causes things to happen. Very subtle, it's like the fragrance of a flower. Nevertheless, it is the active mechanism of material existence and also spiritual existence too. And spiritual desire, that's something else. You do not kill desire. It is the nature of a living entity. Desire. It is impossible to be desireless. But perfection means formerly I was desiring the wrong thing, now I'm desiring the right thing. Yes? And you go on the treadmill. Some schools are teaching hair cultivation, other schools are teaching soul cultivation. Desire. In other words, when you think of the self, you should think desire. The self means desire. You cannot kill desire. But you do want to get rid of material desires to enjoy and exploit naturally. You do want to cultivate spiritual desires of acting for the satisfaction of the source. Behold, Krishna. That is a, in a whole subject of desire. That is the main difference between Krishna consciousness and Buddha's teaching. There's no contradiction up until the point of getting rid of material desire. And that's Buddha stopped right there. And Bhagavad-gita moves on beyond that point. That once you are free from material desire, then what? Up until the point of liberation from material desire, Buddha's teachings and Krishna's teachings coincide almost completely. But in Bhagavad-gita, Krishna is saying that once you understand how to stop material desire, that's not the end of your affairs. Now the real fun begins. So, just like, let's say someone goes to a hairdresser and and that person has a habit of pulling out all his hair in his hair. naturally, first you want to convince that person, don't pull out all your hair. But after that, of course, it's the business of the hairdresser to teach the person what to do with your hair. So simply to teach them or her, don't pull out all your hair, that's just half the job. Now you have to teach the person how to, pluck their hair and, all the stuff you do. So simply to understand that identification with the body and mind is ignorance, and that identification with the temper is ignorance. Simply to understand that is only the beginning. Once you come to that level, then the real fun begins. Now this problem of desire is a very tricky one. It causes a lot of metaphysically minded persons to stumble and can't get over this block about desire. Therefore, you've got some pseudo spiritual teachers who say, just do whatever you feel, and that then you're really becoming spiritual. And then there are others who say, never act according to what you feel, then you're spiritual. But in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna will teach you to purify your material desires so that you can act according to your spiritual desires. But in order to do that, we have to have some humility to accept that. We may be so polluted right now that we have no idea of spiritual desire. It's like a windscreen of a car that's caked with mud. We may think we're seeing, but we possibly were not seeing anything at all. Does anyone know the example about Plato's cave? People in a cave face towards the end of the cave with their backs to the opening. And there's light coming through the opening, but they refuse to turn and look at it. They have a fire lit between themselves and the bottom of the cave, and they're watching the flickering pattern on the wall. Flickering pattern of the flame on the wall. And they refuse to turn around and see that at the opening of the cave there is real light. Much more substantial reality. But they're fascinated by the flickering of the flame of the end wall of the gate. They spend their whole life just watching it. So, it's true, we could say, you know, I'm really going to help you to have a better time watching the flickering of the flame from the wall of the cave. But the real service is to try to get the person to turn around and face the opening of the gate. It just may be that the more comfortable you make them while they're watching the illusion, the more they'll stay in illusion. Yes, it takes, as Joel was saying, it takes courage to turn around. And it all takes courage to help somebody turn around. Because many times they may get angry at you. First they may appreciate, then they may get angry at you. First they may be angry at you, then they'll appreciate. You have to be unconditional in your loving attempt to get them to face, turn and face reality. That's the greatest love. And that's what Krishna is thinking about in Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita takes place on a battlefield. It's spoken on a battlefield. To clearly delineate that help for the material body and mind is most insignificant compared to help for the soul. Krishna specifically teaches Bhagavad Gita on a battlefield in the most provocative circumstances. To see everybody's bodily feelings out into the open, you know? Krishna's churning up the whole situation, you know? Okay, you guys, you living entities, I know you like your bodies. Here we are on a battlefield. I'm going to speak transcendental knowledge on a battlefield in the middle of the war. Now, what are you going to say about that? I remember teacher Swami Prabhupada, his work was quite a deal, it is his work. He was lecturing at a university in Australia, Melbourne or Sydney, one of the unis, and it was during the time of the war in Vietnam. He reached out to the war in Vietnam.
Yes.
So he was lecturing on Bhagavad Gita at that time, and of course, actually, the obvious students were, we don't want to go over there and fight, we don't want this war. But still, Swami Prabhupada would explain Bhagavad Gita as spoken on the battlefield. And so, of course, the students were in no mood to hear the subtleties of the issues. All they heard was war, spoken on the battlefield. Is it that? Krishna is provoking your intelligence. How can there be good happening in the middle of a battle? And why does Krishna want the battle to be fought? In the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna comes up with the most brilliant sociological and psychological reasons why he shouldn't fight, far exceeding the arguments of any contemporary peace activists. And Krishna responds by telling him, you are speaking eloquent words, but you are a fool. Automatically, you become a bit agitated. Wait a minute, this is supposed to be a holy book. And Krishna is supposed to be the all good, infinite love. What's happening here? But really, gets you going. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita, even when seen from the material point of view as a literary masterpiece. Which brings us to point two. When the Gita becomes useless. And turn to text. No, actually we can read the purport of text too, on page 218, please. Those of you who are aware of Eastern literature and metaphysical texts, you know that there are so many versions of Bhagavad Gita. And we'll read a bit about that phenomenon in this purport.
The adventure she consisted of power and wandering citizens, especially her dad, was little used to the humanity system, and it could be taken extended to the other citizens, and would provide them with the adventure, according to her companions. As soon as the original treaty was first passed, the local force of unused citizens and other citizens,
Focus on Bhagavad Gita has to be met head on. Is Krishna an ordinary person, or is Krishna the complete whole? It is impossible to read Bhagavad Gita and accept it head on, and at the same time ignore the proper understanding of Krishna. Yet many people become fascinated by the exciting, stimulating topics in Bhagavad Gita, but they don't want to deal with the Krishna issue. Therefore they just, oh Krishna, very wonderful historical person, very wonderful mythological person. Whereas the whole purpose of Bhagavad Gita is to point out that Krishna is the ultimate reality, the supreme source, the cause of all causes, not an ordinary living entity. In fact, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that even the impersonal oneness, the great white light, the all-pervading spiritual energy, that is his subordinate manifestation. All these things are going on in Bhagavad Gita. And they're all being spoken on the battlefield in about a half hour in between two opposing armies about to fight one another. So Bhagavad Gita becomes useless when you consider it just a a book of metaphysical speculations and notions. The Bhagavad-gita springs to life when you take it as it is. Spoken by it. Absolute reality. Then you move from the platform of theory to the platform of spiritual experience. Simply because you're taking Bhagavad-gita head on as it is. Any questions about point number two? Now some of you may say, well, we've heard so many times, just believe in this, just believe in that. Believe in this and you'll be saved. Believe in that and you'll be saved. Bhagavad-gita is not about belief. Krishna speaks, so you apply what Krishna is saying, and you'll experience. Bhagavad-gita is not about just piling on top of your head a whole system of religious beliefs. Bhagavad-gita is the doorway to spiritual experience. Hear from Krishna and Bhagavad-gita, apply your instruments, your senses, and realize.
How are you supposed to organize it or something like that?
Organize your work situation?
Yes, yes.
Very clear. In Bhagavad Gita, 9th chapter, Krishna says, Patram Pushpam Alam Toyam. You'll make a job for your team. Which number is that verse? Remember the Sanskrit. Okay, 26. Page 486. If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or water, I will accept it. And then the next verse is 627 on the next page, 489. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, whatever austerities you perform, do that, O son of Kunti. Do that as an offering to me. So it's the duty of the human being to organize his life so that all his work is for the pleasure of the supreme source, the pleasure of Krishna. Otherwise, you get karmic reaction. Karmic reaction means you get another body. And the treadmill goes on. Therefore, an essential subject matter in Bhagavad Gita is how to perform non-reactive work. Even if you do a good deed for someone, someone is poor and you give them some money, you have to take birth again so they can pay you back. And they have to take birth again so they can pay you back. So in this way, you're simply pushing on the wheel of your defeated birth and death. The wheel goes on turning. The highest welfare work is to teach someone how not to push on that wheel of defeated birth and death. That's the greatest charity, to teach them how to perform non-reactive work. Therefore, that's something that takes up such a huge portion of Bhagavad Gita. Chaitanya Mano Vishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamaya Tadati Svapalantikam Vaneham Sri Guru Sri Yata Parakamalam Sri Garun Vaishnavam Sri Rupam Sagajatam Sadhana Sadvaitam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Radha Sri Vishakam Vitam Hey Krishna Pavana Sindhu Dina Bandha Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Sapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sukta Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kapaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Pasithanam Adhanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Sivasari Gaur Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Tonight we're going to study a little bit of chapter 4, entitled Transcendental Knowledge. So if we may turn to page 215. If we look upon the whiteboard here, we shall see points for the evening. Number one, the real value of social stability. Number two, when the Gita becomes useless. And number three, who can understand reality? So we'll go over text one briefly as an introduction to our 3 points for tonight. In this text, Krishna, the complete whole, is explaining the history of Bhagavad Gita. Now, if you can suspend whatever judgments have been put into your mind by your schooling about the history of the human race, you just suspend that for a while. Then you can clearly hear Krishna's version of what goes on in the universe in terms of tutelage, education, the dissemination of knowledge. Bhagavad Gita even from the material point of view, is recognized throughout the world as one of the literary classics, and certainly one of the exemplary spiritual texts. That's just something about Bhagavad Gita from the artistic point of view, without actually referring to the potency of its spiritual instruction. Yeah, in this first verse, Krishna is saying that I instructed Bhagavad Gita, this imperishable science of yoga, to the sun god Vibhishwan, and Vibhishwan instructed to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu in turn instructed to Vishvaku. Now you may say, what are these funny sounding names? Is this some kind of Hindu mythology which compares to the Roman mythology and the Greek mythology? The primitive peoples were always assigning personality to everything. Whereas the advanced human beings of today, they understand that there's so many non-personal reasons why things happen. People think that the more personal you refer to energies and powers of the universe, the more aboriginal you are. And the more impersonal you describe the universe, the more intellectual you are. So in this way, people use their intellectual prejudices. They love to talk about black holes, quasars, and subatomic phenomena, but they don't like to think that there can ever be personality superior to natural function. Yet, as much as the so-called intelligent people today are against the personalization of nature, they are always absorbed in personalities when it comes to politics and sports. Like, you have the great America's Cup victory. Everybody knows who the head of the team. I don't wait. Almost everybody knows. And recently, if you go to various petrol stations, I think there's mobile, you can buy little plastic dolls of all the All Black players. Yes. And even old ladies, they can tell you who the starting lineup is, All Black. So that's okay. That's a sign of intelligence. Keeping abreast of it. But when it comes to nature, oh, no personality. It's just molecular forces, atomic forces, gravitational forces. You'd be shocked to realize how human beings today do not want to dare think that there could be entities more intelligent than them. It's amazing how they are so dead against this idea that therefore they construct so many barriers in their mind to thinking that anybody could be, that there could be species and life forms and civilizations much more intelligent and powerful than human beings. There's no rational reason for this other than pride, ego. Of course, they say, well, we haven't seen anybody else besides us. But so what? There's so many things we haven't seen. Not seeing, there's no proof that the thing doesn't exist. so in this first verse, Krishna, the complete whole Supreme Absolute Truth, is speaking. Like you and I can speak, and we are just tiny emanations of the complete whole. Similarly, Krishna is called the Lord God. Without speech in the source, there can be no speech in what comes from the source. So Krishna says, Imangavasute Yogam, Rukhtabad Amabhavyam, Vivasma Manadeva, Manaishvakade Gurdhya. I spoke this Bhagavad Gita before, in millions and millions of years ago. Now, you see, according to Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is explaining this knowledge on the battlefield 5,000 years ago. Just standing up is hard to accept for a materialist because they think that intelligent life basically appeared on this earth a couple thousand years ago, a few thousand years ago. But here, according to the schedule of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita 5,000 years ago to kings, not to cavemen. To very erudite philosopher kings, not even ordinary kings, but philosopher kings. And even more hard and rough to accept with our Western condition is that Krishna is telling Arjuna, according to Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is telling Arjuna 5,000 years ago that millions of years before I spoke this to you, I spoke it to the sun god, the chief executive of the sun. Now, when you hear sun god, and you say, oh, this sounds like the Incas or the Mayans or the, you know, some primitive cosmology. But if I say chief executive of the sun, then you say, well, could be a possibility. What's everybody come up about that? God word. So if you change it to chief executive of the sun, chief administrator of the sun, then people they find that more accessible. Well, the idea is that just that there is one person who is the has the number one post in New Zealand. Similarly, there's one person has the number one post of the sun. And Krishna says, I spoke Bhagavad Gita to that person who has the number one position of the sun millions of years ago. And then that person explained it to his son, Manu. Manu refers to the Sanskrit word Manu, actually from the Sanskrit word Manusha. And guess where man comes from? Sanskrit is generally accepted as the mother of Indo-European language. So, Manu refers to certain posts in the universe for administering the laws of the universe as governing human beings. Just like you have your beehive. Similarly, there is a law formulating body for the universe, supervised by a Manu. So as soon as we get the idea out of our head that human beings are so great, they are the greatest, then we can humbly examine other possibilities of the universe. In fact, when you consult the Vedic literatures, you'll find out that the way human beings are now is not, that's not the most advanced level of human civilization. Not at all. Of course, you have to reformulate your criterion for what makes an advanced civilization. Is it simply industrial technology? Is it silicon technology? Computer technology? What makes for an advanced civilization? In order to actually judge civilization, you have to try out different ways of looking at simplicity. So, in terms of gross industrial technology, this civilization is very, it is that up to its neck. But there are far more subtle material sciences, I think it's spiritual. And this civilization knows nothing about that. When you hear about the growing awareness of different kinds of feeling, then you're basically just dipping your toes in the water at the edge of the ocean of what human civilization can really be involved with. You're allowed to talk about healing aura and opening chakras and different kinds of therapy, aromatherapy, naturopathy, this or that. People are becoming fascinated by these things because they indicate that there's whole systems of dealing with human life in another paradigm, in another frame of reference from what Western civilization is. So, why should there be any wonder when Krishna says, I spoke to Bhagavad Gita millions of years ago, 40 million of years ago, to the chief executive of the sun, and Vivaswami, the chief executive of the sun, passed that knowledge down to his offspring, Manu, who is in charge of the universal law. And then Manu passes to his son, Ikshvaku. So any questions about this planet? If you want knowledge of different planets, then you take knowledge from those who know about life on different planets. Why should you take knowledge about different planets from those who know nothing about it? Far-fetched or plausible? How would you explain it to some of your folks at the hairdressing school?
I would take the attention to my things that we have to do in my every question. These are out of the perspective. I don't know, it's a mystery of this nation. Accuracy or
pre-measuring. Of course, when somebody wants to be a hairdresser, do they just rely on the impersonal powers of nature? No, they go to your school and they learn under somebody. Well, in answer to that point, why don't you turn to the 18th chapter? Ishwar Saga, the Asian magicians, what number is this? Page 845. In reference to Joan's point about people going to different places and being directed. So I will read the Sanskrit and you can read the English. Ishwar Sarva Bhutanam Pradeshe Nuna Tishtati Ramayam Sarva Bhutani Yantra Rudani Maya.
The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart. are our Brahma, and is selecting the wonderings of all living entities, or is it with us, on the sea made of material elements?
Yes. To read the
report, huh? By dealing with what the Supreme Knower, and his decision to fight or not to fight, is confined to the limits of discretion, Lord Krishna instructed that the individual is not all in all. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, or he himself, Krishna, is the localized super soul, sits in the heart directing the living being. After changing body, the living entity forgets his past deeds, but the super soul, as the knower of the past, present and future, remains the witness of all his activities. Therefore, all the activities of living entities are directed by the super soul. The living entity gets what he deserves, and is carried by the material body, which is created in the material energy, under the direction of the super soul. As soon as a living entity is placed in a particular type of body, it has to move under the spell of that bodily situation. A person seated in a high-speed motor car goes faster than one seated in a slow car, though the living entity, the driver, may be the same. Similarly, by the order of the Supreme Soul, material nature fashions a particular type of body to a particular type of living entity, so that he may work according to his past desires. The living entity is not independent. One should not think himself independent of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The individual is always under the Lord's control. Therefore, one's duty is to surrender, and that is the injunction of the Lord.
Yes, so it is a fact. Just taking your hairdressing school example, for those of you who don't know, Jones Foundation, not here. So, yes, everybody's being directed in their wanderings by the manifestation of the complete whole in everyone's heart, known as super soul. Some of you may have heard the notion that the whole is present in every part. That is true. Within every one of the finite parts, the complete whole is present. And that presence is known as the super soul, the supreme soul. Because Krishna is infinite, therefore there are infinite possibilities available. And so Krishna can appear within the finite, even though Krishna is infinite. So, living enemies are wandering here and there, and the super soul is reminding them, he desires, to be a near them. You think you'll be happy in this place? Here's your chance. Go do it. Go talk to John. So in that sense, yes, everybody is being directed. Krishna takes that. Each bar sovereignty. I'm the controller of all the entities. Through the heart, I control. But then you may say, well, Krishna's to blame then. Some people come to hairdressing school and some don't. No, the crucial factor is their desire. That for some people, the hairdressing school, and some people come to hear Bhagavad Gita. It's true, all of this is being directed by Krishna's desire, by living any desire. All this is being coordinated by Krishna, according to the living any. But the whole point is to have the best desire, not to just sit back and say, well, everyone's just in the right place at the right time. It's all going on so perfectly. Whatever everybody does, that's the everything. Just be here now with the everything. And actually, you are the everything. And that's how I'm going to go. Human being means judgment. Discrimination. For example, if you wanted to, you could, John, you could get on an airplane and you could find your way to Algeria right now. You could do that. So shall we say, well, that's just the way she's supposed to be. But actually, it's not a very good place to go to right now. Arms way. Differ, use your discrimination. No! I will postpone my long cherished desire to go to Algeria. This is all about this. So, that judgment we have to use about all things. We have to find out the best thing to do. The best place to go. Not that we just say, well, it's all the interplay of the divine, and they go to here because they go to that place. Let's use that as an example. Of course, even at hairdressing school, we can inspire people on the path of sanity by gradually, through our interaction with them, inspiring them to trying to approach whether we do so. Very easy to do. Oh, you're feeling that you have no idea what the purpose of life is. No. Personally, I really rely on whether we do so. My own personal choice. Who knows? You can find it very fascinating. Yeah, we are personable. Personal. Help someone make a real turn for the better. Rather than just go home feeling good that, oh, that term I've learned in English really finishes so many.
Being fixed,
fabric and moving orderly. They want to count on all that. Of course, much, much more. Now, what is the real purpose of socialism? Is it just that the functions of society go on in an undisturbed way? Or is there another reason? You might like to enlighten us into local notions of why society should be stable or should not be stable.
Why should you say why it should not be stable?
Yes, well, the differing views in
society isn't stable. Society is constantly stable. Nothing is stable. People who crave for that, for
yeah.
problems, for life, because they're relying on experience. I really don't know what to say about that.
For example, you know, like the former Soviet Union, the way it releases things in the media, very unstable politically, economically. The institutions of government cannot be relied upon, the economic institutions cannot be relied upon. There's so much about our daily life that relies on social stability. The bank. Money should be safe in the bank. That's social stability. And the currency shouldn't fluctuate so much. It does, but, and of course, you're getting very disturbed. It affects the price of imports and exports, it affects travel. So the bank is a prime example of social stability. When you put your money in the bank, you are casting your vote for social stability. When I go to the bank next week, my money should be there, and in fact I should get a little interest, and there shouldn't be anything shaking that up.
Well, I mean, it's a little silly. The idea is by putting the money in the bank, you're actually going to do it. Doing in fact the bank people have stored it by money what it is. Which may or may not fill in the word here to put it through the
world. Well, are many people thinking like that? That's what you're asking.
No, not many people are thinking like that. So, a few people in the Asian world have that stuff. It's good on to think about it. I mean, it's a little bit relative.
It's a relative. We're just pointing out the ways in which people rely upon social stability without really thinking about it. Your job. Or if you don't have a job, your social services money. No one wants to see disruption in that. Want your salary from your employment regularly, and it would be nice if there's room for gradual advancement through the ranks. You don't want to see your mortgage rates fluctuating wildly, although as Grant is pointing out very subtly, there are some people who do plan for economic instability and make a profit of it.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, I wasn't just really saying that. All I was saying is all these things are relevant to your particular ideology or your worldview, which may be coming through will deal with spiritual beings. But there are opportunities, surely, who are another element.
And of course, even the opportunists, they rely on some kind of social stability. There has to be some firm position by which you interact with the world. You have to have your feet standing on something. So one way or another, everybody wants to be able to walk out the door of their house and rely on the world being in some way orderly. Why? For the convenience of our sense gratification, or our own pleasure. And it's hard for us to construe living in what we may think are very chaotic places. We wonder, how can people make it, knowing, not knowing what tomorrow brings. In terms of the ordinary social process. I mean, the garbage gets collected regularly here. We take that for granted. In some places, you could never figure out when the garbage is going to be collected. You turn on the tap in your flat or your home, water comes out. Some places, you can't count on that. Generally, according to the predominant worldview, people want to live in places where there is law and order, or when I say law and order, I mean life can go on in an orderly way. They want to live in such places. Just like I was speaking to one lady at a health food store today. She was surprised that I picked out her accent. She was from Sweden, but she had been living in South Africa for 23 years. I had just come to New Zealand last year. So she was surprised how was I just asked her, where are you from? She said, you'll never be able to guess. You're from Sweden. She'd been living in South Africa for 23 years as a development worker. And then, because social circumstances changed there, she wanted more stability, so she came to New Zealand. Thinking, yes, it'll be more orderly here. I was very attached to my developmental work amongst the downtrodden people of South Africa, but my life, I felt that in my life I needed some order. I needed to wake up the next day and, you know, the garbage would be collected on time, the social functions of society would go on in a predictable way without huge uprisings and disturbances. So this is the common conception of why there should be social stability. So that we can get on with our lives in a predictable way. But Krishna, in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, is also talking about stability. We'll see more of that in text 2. Page 218. Evam parampara praptam emam rajasya viju sakalena mahata yoga nashta parantapa.
Paul, would you like to read the translation? This is a great song, especially in the Chinese format. As a
as it is, it is really good. Yeah. So, actually, the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita is meant for those who are administering society. And the purpose of social stability from the transcendental standard is to ensure that there is a harmonious environment, an orderly environment for the dissemination of transcendental knowledge, not just for economic development.
Say that again.
To make sure that there is a peaceful and orderly situation in society so that transcendental knowledge can be taught and distributed. As opposed to trying to make a so-called peaceful and orderly environment so that economic affairs can go on without trouble. Nevertheless, it is true. A skillful businessman or woman can make a profit in chaos. In fact, some business persons do specialize in making profit in chaos. In fact, some will even admit they cause chaos because that way they can make more profit. But we're speaking of general notions. So, Bhagavad Gita is spoken and passed down through philosophers, chief executives, philosophers who have a talent for administration as well as a philosophical capacity. And they manage society so that the social world is peaceful and orderly. In this way, people with undisturbed minds can focus on understanding reality. This is a far cry from managing society so that there is order for the purpose of economic development, or so that there is lack of order to contribute to economic development. Some people have a hard time today seeing that there's more to social peace and order than just a good climate for economic affairs. When society simply has as its cherished goal economic development, then people cannot be happy. But that is not the purpose. True, there should not be people starving. But it is also true that even if you're in an unfortunate material situation of starvation, if you are equipped with spiritual knowledge about how you're not the body, then even in the most disastrous situations, you'll have inner equilibrium. Just like today, there were rains and winds at the same time. Apparently these things were going on. But, because one is having an umbrella or coat, jacket, not disturbed by these things. Well, they're happening. So in this world there will always be disturbances. But if we learn how not to be disturbed by the disturbance, that is the greatest wealth. So Krishna is saying that this supreme science and its distribution is the real purpose why society should be arranged in a peaceful and orderly way. Because in order to learn this very extraordinary knowledge of Bodhisattva. People's minds have to be calm. If the people are always agitated by hankering, longing for material gain, they'll never be able to calmly understand Bodhisattva. Therefore, these philosopher kings took it as their job to make sure that society was well ordered and efficient, not for economic development, but for spiritual development. Because when people are disturbed about maintaining their bodies, how can they hear clearly? Although it is a fact that ultimately, if you know about your spiritual identity, it doesn't matter what condition your body is in. But that is a rare or not ordinary level. Most people are very affected by whatever condition their body is in. Therefore, the philosopher kings who taught Bhagavad Gita and passed it down, father to son, they knew most people are affected by their bodily condition. We want to make sure that everybody can eat without anxiety